Over the course of his short but meteoric career, Andy Smerick has been a legislative aide, an executive of a charter school advocacy organization, a White House fellow, a senior official at the U.S. Department of Education, and the deputy superintendent of New Jersey's schools. Now you can add author to the list after the publication of his recent book, The Urban School System of the Future. In it, Smerick imagines urban schools without a system and makes the case, in his words, that the urban school district is, quote, irreparably broken. Today, we talk with Smerick about his book and his contention that reformers must give up on fixing districts if we are ever to create urban schools worth attending. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Yeah. You know, now Andy and I, you should know, listeners are good friends. And so that means I have an obligation to be especially tough on you.
Oh, no. The other direction, please.
And on your book. Okay.
Kid gloves.
All right, Andy. Well, let's get into it here. A very important new book out. First of all, and you almost apologized for this in your introduction, why yet another book on urban education reform?
Yeah, I actually purposely did that. I think in the first paragraph, you can't get out without my saying that something along the lines of the education writer of today bears a particular burden, because there's this consensus now that to do especially urban education reform, there are a set of reforms that we just need backbone, we just need spine, and if we do those, then things are going to get better, that it's a matter of political will. And my argument that I try to make in the introduction and throughout is that I have the opposite take, which is that it's a lack of an understanding of why we got where we are, and then the types of things that we need to move forward. So I make the case, I try, that yes, it's tough to blaze new trails in this field, but it has to be blazed. The reason why we haven't gotten where we need to is because we've been doing the wrong things.
Right. So when you hear people say, we know what works,
yeah,
we just have to do it, or it's all about implementation, you disagree.
I do. And part of this, it makes me feel like the old guy in the room constantly. But I think our generation of reformers needs to have a little humility and realize that we are not the first people who have a fever for making sure that urban schools get better. We're not the first set of people involved in philanthropy or advocacy who've been trying to do this. This has been a 50-year effort, and things in the past have not worked. And that's how I kind of approached this. Why is it the case that smart, hardworking, dedicated, civic-minded people have been unable to make urban K-12 education better? And it has to be a systemic problem. It didn't seem like a management problem to me.
And your basic argument is the reason they have failed is that they continue to have hope in the urban school district.
Precisely. That I'm trying to get people to realize that I guess there are two things to keep in mind. The big one is that we call it an urban school system, and a system implies that there are a lot of moving parts all working together, when in fact what we actually have is a monolith, a single organization that owns and operates virtually all public schools in a geographic area. Ted Coldery had this wonderful line, something along the lines of exclusive territorial franchise, that the district owns, operates all the schools within geographic boundaries. That's not really a system. It's an entity, and there are fundamental problems with that. And the second piece that I think is even more important to get people over the initial hurdle of, I guess, getting on my team, is that the district is not synonymous with public education. You can have public education, which is a set of principles, a set of beliefs, without having the district. Yes, they've been linked for the past 100 years because of historical anomalies, but you can have public education in all of its great glory and get rid of the district, and that's what I'm arguing for.
All right, now let me push you on something. You've said in the book and many other statements that you are, quote, sector agnostic.
Yes.
In other words, you're not saying you're necessarily in favor of charter schools over district schools or private schools. Let's say there's three sectors, right?
That's right.
District, charter, private.
Correct.
Yet you seem pretty antagonistic towards the district sector.
I am, because it has had 50 years to do what should be its core competency, which is well educate the kids that are assigned to its schools. And I can't find a single example of a single year in a single city where a single urban school district has succeeded in that since, call it, the mid-1960s. So maybe it's the case that this is a coincidence that we have, call it, 5,000 consecutive iterations of failure from urban districts, and maybe we're just luckily going to happen upon a success eventually. But the district has not succeeded. And so my view is, let's stop thinking about sector. Let's stop this warfare between the three and just judge schools based on quality, their performance, and then build a system around that.
All right. But you sound like you say you're agnostic, and yet it sounds like you basically want to put a stake in the heart of districts. No.
If a district can prove me wrong and prove history wrong and actually run great schools, that's fantastic. So in the book, what I argue is that we just need to look at districts as what I'm going to, from this point on, just call school management organizations. It's like a charter management organization or an education management organization. It is an entity that runs a set of schools as a central office. The district historically has had a privileged place in the landscape that it gets to decide if its schools stay open or if they close or what kind of schools to run, and I'm trying to bring that to an end. So if Dr. Alonzo in Baltimore or John Deasy in LA or name your reform-minded superintendent, if they can run some set of great schools in a geographic area, bless them. They can continue doing it, but we are no longer going to say that we should no longer allow the district to survive in perpetuity just mm-hmm. because it's there. They only get to survive if they run great schools.
All right. Now let me keep pushing.
Yeah,
I promised
please.
I would.
Come on.
All right. So this contention that there are no successful urban districts, mm-hmm. Wouldn't the people at the Broad Prize disagree? I mean, every year they identify a school district that's doing a good job getting student achievement results, districts like Long Beach, California, that people may look to. Mm. What's wrong with that point of view?
So I'm hesitating saying this because I have such admiration for the people at the Broad Foundation and the idea behind the Broad Prize. But after they awarded the award to Miami this year, I went on the website of what's called NAEP-TUDA, the Trial Urban District Assessment. So NAEP, which has been around mm-hmm. for a generation plus, decided several years back mm-hmm. that they were going to allow a set of urban districts to take the NAEP. And so there are 20 plus that take it right now. If you were to go to that website and look at Miami's test scores on NAEP, it would take your breath away. Miami is just like Cleveland and Detroit and Baltimore and the other districts that are taking this. We're talking 10-15% of eighth graders proficient in math reading. Is that really what we're aspiring to? This is what gives me such energy. If we're calling success 15% of eighth graders being proficient in reading and math, if that is how low our standards are right now, something is fundamentally wrong. So yes, Miami may be best of the breed currently, but that breed is god-awful and poor kids are suffering because of it.
Well, and you bring up poor kids in poverty. So people would say, well, look, we know there's this huge link between demographics and achievement. Mm-hmm. If those kids in Miami are making big gains every year, maybe the Miami is a very effective school system.
So I wanted to make sure that I wasn't off base on this. So I said, well, maybe it's the case that exactly this, that Miami's making gains. So in 5 years from now or 10 years from now, it's going to be hitting the ball out of the park. So what I did is I looked at previous winners of the Broad Prize. Houston, for example, won a decade ago to see, okay, well, they were making progress then. So they must be knocking the ball out of the park now. Take a look at their NAEP-TUDA scores. 10, 15, 20% proficiency.
All right, but not just progress in terms of getting kids to proficiency. Progress in helping kids get from, say, they come into school three grade levels below mm-hmm. and they catch up over time. I mean, if we're measuring the quality of schools, isn't that a fairer way to look? And because otherwise, we've got this, we know demographics matter. Otherwise, mm-hmm. what you're going to do is you're going to look at urban districts and say they're failing. Mm-hmm. And it could be that what they really are, they serve a lot of poor kids.
They do.
You look at suburban districts and say, well, they're doing pretty well, when maybe they're not actually well organized or doing anything good educationally. They just have kids who are coming in already meeting the standards.
Correct. So that's why in each, the book is arranged in four sections, and the first three, one is dedicated to each of the different sectors, traditional public, charter public, and then non-public or private. And what I show is even when you look at the poorest of all poor schools, those that have 60% free and reduced price lunch or greater, you have this phenomenon that the statisticians call heteroskedasticity. What that generally means is that there is greater variation when two variables are correlated. There is greater variation at one end of the spectrum. And so what in city after city, sector after sector, I found is that when you have low poverty schools, they are uniformly high performing. But when you have high poverty schools, there is this great variation. You have very low performers, you have middling performers, but you also have very high performers. So this is a roundabout way of getting to your question. Yes, all of these districts, there could be some that are making progress if they have kids that are behind, but eventually if they're making progress with their kids, you're going to see high levels of proficiency. Eventually they're going to hit it. And what we're finding in city after city is there are these outliers in the charter sector, the private sector, and the district sector. My argument is we need to build a system around those high performers as opposed to around a sector.
Okay. And one last question on this one. So why, though, do you focus just on urban districts? I mean, is your view that the school district in the suburbs is functioning well enough, and so we don't need to dismantle it in the same way we do in the cities?
I'd probably word it differently, but this is what I'd say, is there are rural school problems that I wish I had more time to work on, and I plan to dedicate time to them. There are suburban school problems. There are higher education problems. This book, I thought, needed to focus narrowly on something. I only had 50, 60,000 words to spend. And I think that the challenges that urban districts have are unique. And the systems we need to put in place to overcome those challenges, we need to put a whole lot of energy and thinking into this. It's different than it is in different places. And what I can say for a fact is that the system that we have in urban areas, it's not solving the problem.
Okay. All right. So a big part of your book and your argument is that what we really need, the centerpiece of the system needs to be chartering. Not charter schools per se, but chartering, which
That's
means
right.
that a public entity overseeing a set of providers, nonprofit, for-profit, religious, et cetera, so that the government doesn't necessarily run the schools, but oversees the schools that are actually doing the work or organizations that are running the schools. But you know, you make this case for chartering, and yet many people would say, hey, we've had this experience 20 years with chartering, and many of those charter schools are just as abysmal as the traditional public schools.
Mm-hmm.
So aren't you just repeating the same mistakes we've made now for 20 years?
No. And unlike some other writers out there, I will concede this point. I mean, the data is pretty clear that there is a wide array of performance around charter schools in every city that I looked in. So, I mean, the proposition one, that's true. But the case that I make in what I think is probably the penultimate chapter of this is that there are places where when chartering is done right, you get these extraordinary results. And the example that I like to give to people is a medical one, which is if you have a patient and who's diabetic and you prescribe him or her insulin and he or she decides not to take it, and he or she then gets quite sick, you don't throw your hands up in the air and say, insulin no longer works for diabetes. You say, this intervention was not applied properly, therefore it didn't get the results we wanted. If you have chartering in a city and you have a low quality authorizer and you don't monitor quality and you don't recruit the very best operators and you don't allow the best ones to expand and replicate and you don't close the low performing ones and you don't allow the right new ones to start up, that means you're taking an intervention, chartering, and applying it poorly. So we shouldn't be surprised if we get bad results. So where has it been applied well? New York City and New Orleans, and all the data we have out there, the gold standard studies are showing amazing things are happening. And to pat the New Jersey people on the back a little bit, and I played a small part in this, a recent study came out from Credo, which has been critical of chartering in some places, that showed outrageously great results in Newark related to chartering. Why? Well, we closed down low-performing charters, and we allow KIPP and uncommon schools to replicate, and we were tight, we being the authorizer, on who we allow in. So if you follow what I call the four principles of chartering, and you do chartering right, you're going to get better results, meaning moving the quality curve to the right. So chartering in and of itself isn't magical. It's doing it the right way.
But haven't we learned that closing down charter schools turns out to be politically challenging, just like closing down traditional public schools? So what gives you confidence that the politics are going to change so that there's going to be more of these school districts or cities, let's say like Newark and New Orleans, and less like the ones where the bad charters just go on and on and on?
Well, yeah, there are always going to be politics around all things education. And many people have written about the difficulty of closing charter schools. And I have been on the bad end of a charter closure in two different ways. I helped start a charter school that had to get closed for facility reasons. And then I was an authorizer, so having to close charters. And I know how painful that can be. But I also know how painful it can be when you have an education system that keeps bad schools open in perpetuity. So the answer is, do I have faith that the politics will change? Marginally. I think over time, people can get accustomed to the idea of saying schools need to close if they're low performing. But I also think we can get much better about weeding out low performers before they open up their doors, and then creating enough high performing schools that closures become less likely.
You mentioned the quality curve just a moment ago. You write about this quite a bit. And you write about it and how it plays out somewhat differently for district, charter, and private schools. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was fascinating. So I was able to get data through traditional means for traditional public schools and charter schools. But then I had to do some digging and some cajoling to get the private school data. So to talk about the first two, what I find is what I alluded to earlier, that there is this just shockingly wide distribution in quality among the most low-income schools. So you could have a city, whether it's Detroit or Cleveland or Washington, D.C., two traditional public schools that have virtually identical high poverty rates, call it 90% free and reduced price lunch, and yet in one of them, 90% of their kids are proficient in reading and math, and in the other one, it's 20%. And this isn't just one city, it's city after city after city. And it just takes a normal curve distribution, a bell curve that anyone in statistics is familiar with. But the breadth of it is interesting, and you see this in the charter sector and the traditional public sector. Private schools, it's more difficult to find the data because they don't have to take state tests in the same way or report the findings. So I was able to get creative and use some other studies that have been done for other purposes to use their data, and found the same thing. And then I was able to get two large Catholic archdioceses that run a whole lot of urban Catholic schools to give me their free and reduced price lunch data and their test score data. They take standardized tests, and lo and behold, found the exact same thing. A lot of these Catholic schools are doing what some of the great scholars have taught us, Bright and others, that Catholic schools in urban areas can do amazing things, but there are also high poverty Catholic schools in urban areas that are getting really bad results.
So are the curves all just simple bell curves and they all look pretty much the same?
In some senses, in the private sector, I found, and a little bit in the charter, well, let's go to private first. In private sector, it appears that there is a wider distribution, so the standard deviation would be bigger. It's just more spread out, so you're going to have more at the high end and more at the low end. Mm-hmm. And this is actually kind of intuitive. Fewer regulations, and you might be able to see, okay, you're going to get some that really fall off the table and some that do great. The charter sector was fascinating. In city after city, although the standard deviation might look about the same as the traditional public school, meaning the mean is about the same and then the how the spread looks, there was what I just called the right side bump on the high end, high performing end. You had a larger number than you might expect. Mm-hmm. And these are traditionally the high performing CMOs that have been able to replicate and expand.
Right. And some people have found this other in California, for example, some studies showing this U curve in the charter school sector, this disproportionate number on the low end and disproportionate on the high end. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk about the low end for all these sectors. We've got these bad schools out there. How about turning them around?
Yeah. Yeah, let's try that again. I'm smiling because this has become sort of a hobby horse of mine unintentionally. A couple years ago, I started doing research on turnarounds and was just amazed at the results I was finding. And at the very same time, the U.S. Department of Education decided to sink $5 billion into this effort, which is a shame. The short story here is that there have been efforts over decades and decades and decades they always have different names, but they always amount to the same thing, that we are going to put new energy, vigor, money, human capital into making our low-performing schools better, and they always turn out the same. A lot of money, a lot of time spent, and a lot of schools staying as bad as they had been before. Just variations on a theme, different names, and this current iteration under the name SIG, the School Improvement Grant, is going to be the most famous, the most expensive, and I think ultimately the saddest, because we're early indications are it's about the same.
So what's the alternative, though?
Shut them down. Low-performing schools have no right to kids, I believe, just because you were set up in a geographic area and you were set up to educate kids based on neighborhood residents doesn't mean you have the right to do a bad job of it. So if you are low performing over time and reasonable efforts to make that school better don't succeed, you need to be closed. And this doesn't mean closing 50 schools in one city all in one year. It means making closures part of a regular process, part of these four principles I talk about, that you have a set of these activities, new starts, closures, replications, expansions, ensuring diversity and ensuring parental choice. And when you do those things together, that's a real system of public education where you have healthy churn and those schools go away. And hopefully you move the curve to the right because of it.
Let's talk about, you said ensuring diversity. You mean diversity of educational options?
That's right. I think that a big part of success is actually making sure that kids and their parents are able to choose the type of school that best meets their needs. And one school doesn't always meet the needs of all kids. So I wouldn't be happy if a city had nothing but KIPP schools. I'd love it if it had a critical mass of them, but they're outward bound schools. They're name the different types of models that could work. And I think it is important to enable parents to choose. That's a big part of the equation.
But there's a tension here, right? Because some of those educational models may not get very good results on test scores. And parents may not care. They might say, hey, this school is giving me something else valuable, whether something basic like safety, or maybe the school doesn't do great on test scores, but has other evidence that kids go on to do great things. They go into college at higher rates, or they go on to get certificates that allow them to get into skilled trades. But the kids don't do well on the test scores. And according to the test scores, maybe they should get closed down. How do you wrestle with those kinds of conflicts?
So I'll disagree with your question a bit and then concede some of it and answer that. So generally, I think it's a canard that there are hundreds, maybe thousands of schools out there that are doing great work for kids, and yet their test scores are awful. Yes, I can make an argument that there are some schools, especially that serve adjudicated youth or kids who have dropped out or kids with special needs, or you can come up with several categories where their test scores may not be spectacular, but I have yet to see a school where kids are, 1-3% proficient. And then I would say, that's still a great school. So I think that this is inflated, the idea that there are lots of schools that fall outside of the universe of test score evaluation. But having said that, the way that I look at this is we as the government, the state, when we're thinking about portfolio management of schools, we need to kind of be in the role of the FAA. The FAA, a federal agency that oversees airline safety. So we allow consumers to pick whether they want to fly on Delta or Southwest or pick the carrier. And they can do it based on rates or schedules or if they like the pilots better. Mm-hmm. But there is a certain standard that every single airline has to get over, and that's a quality line, that safety is absolutely not an option. That's not debatable. If you get over that quality bar, then we allow consumers to choose. And that's how we have to think about the set of schools. I want diversity. I think diversity is wonderful. I argue for it, but it's not diversity without any constraints on it. You don't have the right to run a different type of awful school. You have the right to run a different type of high performing school.
So in your vision, the school district, as we know it today, goes away.
The school district as the default delivery system goes away. Okay. But it would have the right to run schools, like I said, if it can do a good job. Mm-hmm. But I think part of this story is I think we would quickly see that if we put the district on the same playing field as charters and non-public schools, hold them all accountable and so forth, we would quickly see that the district would be hampered and would be unable to in most places meet the standards in the same way of some other schools. And that's a whole set of other questions, what happens then. But I remain open to the idea that there could be a couple outlier districts mm-hmm. that could run some good schools.
Okay. All right. So, but let's say the schools are basically independently run throughout the city, mm-hmm. Variety of providers. Aren't you worried that there's some things you lose when you lose this kind of coordination and coordinated system? So I'll throw some out there. Mm-hmm. All right. We know from a recent Fordham Institute study in Ohio mm-hmm. that among poor kids, there's a huge rate of student mobility. Mm-hmm. Kids are moving around all the time. And unfortunately, not a lot of evidence that they're necessarily moving from bad schools to good schools.
That's right.
All right. But their families are moving. Their families are in crisis. They're going from apartment house to apartment house, and the kids move schools as a result. Mm-hmm. If all of these schools are run independently, isn't that a recipe for chaos?
No, not if you if you can mitigate it. So this is absolutely a legitimate concern. So I don't mean to dismiss it at all. But there are other sectors out there that deal with similar problems and can get around it. So some of this is just technical. If you have a good data system, a good tracking system, and you have a central authority like I argue for, like this chancellor system, where you can track students and make sure that the kids are getting the services that they need and so forth, you can get around this. I mean, we can't stop student mobility. This is tied to things completely unrelated to education in many cases, like you alluded to. Families moving from apartment building to apartment building. It's just, how do we track kids and make sure that they get the services that they need? I mean, the counter argument is the district is doing a great job of that right now. I can't find that that's actually the case. It might seem like it's more uniform, but that doesn't mean that they're succeeding.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the question about whether this is really parental choice or it's the schools choosing the kids, right? That in a system where all these independent schools, you have incentives perhaps for these schools to try to work the system to cream, to push kids out who aren't getting good results. Mm-hmm. How do you think through those kinds of issues?
This ends up being in the set of the trickiest issues once this gets implemented. And I have colleagues at Bellwether who have written this wonderful report called The Hangover about teacher evaluations. And what, in effect, they're saying is, yeah, the teacher evaluation movement over the past couple of years has been good, but now that we've implemented it, there's some things we didn't think about. How do we wrestle with them? And I'm recommending such a big change here that I can envision myself or someone else were this to happen 3 or 4 years from now saying, okay, here are the things that we should have thought of in advance. Some of the unknown unknowns. This is what I think is one of the known unknowns, one of these really big challenges. How do you, for example, if we start to implement this, make sure that the district doesn't end up in this awful position of being the educator of last resort, that only parents who choosy parents pick charters or private schools, and then the district is left with kids who are the most challenging to educate for a whole host of different reasons. So there are ways to get around this that become tough that actually put a bigger burden on charters. So for example, I would envision a system where we would want every parent to choose, but for the parents who don't, every single school would have a region of residence, and this would include some charters. Mm-hmm. So a charter wouldn't be able to say we're only going to be based on choice. Hopefully it would be predominantly, but not solely. And then there are these other issues that there are some charter schools who decide they're a middle school, that they'll take new students in fifth grade, maybe in sixth grade, but their model doesn't allow them to take new students in seventh or eighth grade because of cultural reasons. Mm-hmm. That might have to change in some places. But these are fair implementation questions, and they tie to a lot of things. Like Checker, as you know, just recently wrote a book about exam schools. Mm-hmm. Is there room in a portfolio of schools for selective admission? Is there room for schools that focus just on kids with autism? These are tough things. I don't have answers to all of this yet, but it's worth considering when we move to a portfolio approach, what is fair and what's not.
All right, good. Andy, a really important book, a great contribution. Let me ask you one last question. Yep. You spent something like 3 years working on this book, though not full time. You
That's
were
right.
busy uh-huh. Being the deputy superintendent in New Jersey and having a brood of children.
That's right.
But tell me, what did you learn over the course of doing this book? Did anything change? Did your mind change about any of this stuff while researching and writing this book?
It did. And the best advice I got when I was setting out to write the book was by someone affiliated with Education Next, Hoover, a guy named Bill Evers, who's written a series of books. And he said, come up with your theory of the book, write your introduction, outline your book, write it, and then throw away the introduction. Don't even bother looking at it because your thinking over the time will have changed so much. Just rewrite the introduction and then send it off. And that was this lesson to remain open-minded that over time you are going to change in the exercise. And I had this blessing of not only having a long time to write it, but having this career-changing event of being the deputy in a big state that is diverse. And probably the thing that struck me the most is I used to focus so much on the dysfunction of failing schools. I have a greater appreciation than ever before for the dysfunction of failing districts, that the dysfunction of school boards in these areas, the lack of capacity within the district and our big cities in most of these cases, schools are handicapped from the beginning. Even if you have great principals and great staff in a lot of these places, just the ickiness from the district, unable to deliver books on time or to get hiring on time, it makes it tough to run these schools. So district dysfunction was my biggest lesson learned.
And as you say, we have to decide that they are irreparably broken so we can move on to something else.
And completely dispensable.
All right. So once again, Andy Smerick's new book is The Urban School System of the Future. A little bit of a funny title, considering that you're arguing against systems, at least as we currently know them. You can find that in multiple places, including Amazon. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
Real pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.